بيده يرفعه.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Forgive the shortcomings of considerate people, because when they fall into error, Allah raises them up."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we find that the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is truly universal because the statements and the actions and the behaviors of Imam Ali alayhi salam are still very much applicable to the present day. We find in one of Imam Ali alayhi salam's sermon, he was speaking about individuals who are in the action of the dispensation of justice among the people, but they are not fit for it. Meaning they are leaders in one form or the other, they are judges in one form or the other, they are in positions of power in one form or the other, but for some reasons, they are not fit for it. Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about two major reasons why these individuals are not fit for being leaders or people in power or in the position of the dispensation of justice. One person was one who was devoted to their own self. They only cared about themselves. They were selfish. They were arrogant. They were conceited. Pretty much they only cared about their own benefit and their own loss. Imam Ali alayhi salam also said that this individual is one of the two people that are detested by Allah. Imam Ali alayhi salam continues and he says that the other person who is detested by Allah and the other person whom is not fit for the dispensation of justice or to be in a position of power or to be in a position of leadership is he who has picked up ignorance. Imam Ali alayhi salam says that this individual who has picked up ignorance, he moves among the ignorant and is senseless in the thick of mischief and is blind to the advantages of peace. Those resembling men have named him a scholar, but they are not so. A very powerful statement. Of course, the two people that are detested by Allah, one who is devoted to their self and the other who has picked up ignorance. Now, ignorance can be a simple ignorance or a compound ignorance. A simple ignorance meaning that one just simply does not know. A compound ignorance is one that who does not know that they do not know. So this compound ignorance is something that is very difficult to tackle because you first have to explain the person that they don't know, and then that person has to realize what it is that they don't know. Whereas the first person, they simply know that they don't know, right? In both situations, this ignorance that has been picked up by an individual is something that is incredibly dangerous. This individual who is in a position of the dispensation of justice, he will move around among the ignorant rather than being among those that are knowledgeable. And even though they do not know it, but they are lost, dumb, and blind in the thick veil of mischief, and of course they are blind to the advantages of peace. And as a final point, it's interesting that Imam Ali alayhi salam says that the people who call such an individual a scholar are in fact people who merely resemble men and human beings. In reality, they themselves are not even qualified to be called human beings, we must be very careful from this concept and this issue of ignorance when it comes to our dispensation of justice among the people. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRabi English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master, and my Lord. Welcome, my friends. Keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the folly, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
إنك على كل شيء
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
And this is where we see that when it comes to the sense of adl and justice, you know, Amir al-Mu'mineen was very well known. And it's not only among the men that we hear, even the women who were there, you know, supporting his cause. And later on, they had this, you know, willingness to stand up in front of Muawiyah, in a very threatening situation, but still remembering Ali and praising Ali. There are similar events like this. It's very interesting that the Sunni scholars themselves have actually compiled a book, a booklet, where the title in Arabic says that, you know, the women who went and confronted Muawiyah. There is one version of it which says the women who said La to Muawiyah. I mean, that was their attitude. And these, if you look at those stories, you will see most of them were from the Shi'i community of the time. One of them actually, when Muawiyah at the end listened to the whole story, he says, what do you want? And she says, you know, these are the requests that I have, the list, what we want. And Muawiyah said, I'll give you more than that. Will I be replaced with Ali in your heart then? And she says, no. You can give me whatever you want. And I'm sure if I had gone to Ali and asked for that, he would have said that no, because Ali would not give to anyone anything from Baytul Mal, but that person has the right for it. You are just giving it because you want to please people. And so that is the difference between you and Ali. So don't ask me that, you know, by giving me things, I'm going to replace, you know, Ali with you in my heart. No, that is still something we cannot negotiate on that issue. And so this is the sense of adl that we see at that time, which also manifests when we look at this Christian writer that I mentioned yesterday, that he gives this title, Sawtul Adalatil Insaniya to Ali, the voice of human justice. This is amazing that there are so many personalities in the history of Islam. You know, he is not even a Shi'i, he is a Christian. But when he studies, he sees that this title, that someone becoming the voice of human justice, does not apply to anyone but Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wa salam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
America has conducted nearly 400 interventions since its founding, with more than a quarter in the last 30 years. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Nick Turs, writer. This article is published under the heading, Report Shows Post-9/11 Era, One of the Most Militarily Aggressive in U.S. History. Here's more. The United States has conducted nearly 400 military interventions since 1776, according to innovative research by scholars Sidita Kushi and Monica Duffy. Half of those conflicts and other uses of force, including displays and threats of force, as well as covert and other operations, occurred between 1950 and 2019, the last year covered in a new data set introduced by Kushi and Toft in a Journal of Conflict Resolution published earlier this week. More than a quarter of them have taken place since the end of the Cold War. The United States has carried out 34% of its 392 interventions against countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, 23% in East Asia and the Pacific region, 14% in West Asia and North Africa regions, and just 13% in Europe and Central Asia, according to a newly refined version of the Military Intervention Project, a venture of the Center for Strategic Studies at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. In addition to providing the most accurate count ever of U.S. military interventions, doubling the number of cases found in existing data while also employing rigorous sourcing methods, the MIP offers 200 variables that allow for complex analysis of drivers and outcomes of wars and other uses of force. Crucially, the writers of the report, the directors of Fletcher's School Center for Strategic Studies, found that U.S. interventions have increased and intensified in recent years. While the Cold War era and the period between 1868 to 1917 were the most militaristically active for the United States, the post-9/11 era has already assumed third position in all of the U.S. history. Unlike earlier eras in which displays and threats of force were employed, such posturing short of military violence has been absent in recent years. The United States, they found, has actually engaged in 30 interventions as level 4 usage of force or 5 war. Until the end of the Cold War, the U.S. military hostility was generally proportional to that of its rivals. Since then, the U.S. began to escalate its hostilities as its rivals de-escalated, marking the beginning of America's more kinetic foreign policy. This recent pattern of international relations, conducted largely through armed force, what experts has termed kinetic diplomacy, has increasingly targeted the West Asia-North Africa region. These regions have been both large-scale U.S. wars, as in Afghanistan and Iraq, and low-profile combating nations such as Burkina Faso, Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Chad, and Tunisia. The data incorporates confirmed covert operations and low-profile interventions by special operations forces, but a combination of U.S. government secrecy and the dataset's scrupulous sourcing standards guarantees that post-9/11 tally is an undercount, according to experts. Recently, for example, it is revealed that the existence of low-profile proxy war programs run across Africa, the West Asia region, and the Indo-Pacific region, while experts say that the Pentagon has likely used the secretive 127E authority to carry out combat beyond the scope of any authorization for use of military force or permissible self-defense in violation of the Constitution. Such highly classified operations may evade capture in the MIP data set. While 127E programs in Somalia and Yemen, for example, overlap with known U.S. military interventions, other uses of the authority, such as in Egypt and Lebanon, may not. The same goes for even lesser-known authorities like Section 12-02, which provides support to foreign irregular forces aimed at near-peer competitors. As the data set is further developed and refined, experts hope that it will allow for more nuanced understanding of the conditions that cause the United States to launch military interventions and the effects on the U.S. and the nations it targets, including the economic and human toll and inadvertent outcomes. What they ask were the longer-term costs and unintended consequences of the interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq, and how did that intervention influence U.S. engagements in Libya, Syria, and Yemen? The answers, they hope, will lead to improved data and, ultimately, a better U.S. foreign policy. Thank you.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And we would like to actually express our condolences sorrow and sadness for this holy month, the month of Muharram, actually, and the martyrdom of the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, peace be upon him. Well, we're going to talk about some of the laws related to Muharram according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speakers. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the morning laws or the mourning ceremony's laws about the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini, let me ask you this question. You know, is it permissible to jog and utter the names of the infallibles successively and quickly in the mourning ceremonies?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, jogging is sometimes, you know, is a term that is usually referred to harwala. That's the word, the proper word used in Arabic language.
Mm-hmm.
So the practice of harwala is permissible. No religious authority has, because harwala means running quickly and briskly. So it is permissible, and there's no objection to someone walking briskly and jogging and uttering the names of the pure imams and the infallible imams successively and quickly. There is no objection. And of course, I as far as I know, this is a very common practice in Iraq. And when you go to the holy city of Karbala, you find Iraqis rushing to the holy shrine of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam and Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas alayhi salatu wasalam, walking briskly and jogging, and of course it's a common practice. There's no problem in it. And Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that as long as it does not lead to a bad image, there is no objection in it.
Mm-hmm, I see. The other question that is somehow prevalent to some degree. In fact, you might hear uncommon expressions in such ceremonies, sure. All right, in the mourning ceremonies. Not to mention maybe some of them are improper, basically.
Yes.
All right. Is there any, technical problem or jurisprudential problem with, the use of such expressions such as "I am Hussein's dog," for example, in such commemorative ceremonies?
Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, says that it's not advisable to utter such expressions. And the believers had better observe the standards of commemorating the martyrdom of the infallibles, especially Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. So using such expressions is a kind of degrading. It's no religious authority has advised this, and it's better and advisable, according to His Eminence, to avoid such expressions.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, and what is the ruling, what is the Islamic law about using musical instruments? Sometimes you would see that in the commemorative marches, they use such instruments as organs.
Yes. Well, using musical instruments is inappropriate, and it's befitting for mu'mineen, for Muslims, to avoid using such instruments in the commemoration ceremonies in the majalis of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam. And it's preferable to hold communication, ceremonies and commemoration ceremonies in the traditional way, which does not involve any kind of music. You know, there is one thing we should note, and that is musical instruments can be misused in different ways. If it is allowed by one religious authority or by the religious authorities, then there is no limit, there is no bound,
mm-hmm,
as to how these instruments be used and what kind of music should be played, of course, because there are different kinds of music, and of course it will become a license at the end of the day for some people to exploit and to use this kind of permission, this permission to play any kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
Some music, maybe some types of music are quite clearly offensive. They are licentious, they are frivolous. And therefore, in order to prevent such things, the religious authorities consider playing music as something inappropriate.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Thank you for listening to the program. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Slang Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
I work in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you, who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces, who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing in my veins, who are you? To me, desire, desire, drink some water. Desire.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. It's Muhammad Jawad hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid is still in the program as our guest speaker. We are still talking about the jurisprudential rules of the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein in the month of Muharram, according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, as a result of taking part in the commemorative ceremonies of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, a worshipper missed out on some of the devotions, some of the rituals that he or she had to do, such as the morning prayer, for example. Isn't it better, do you think, for this worshipper to avoid going to such commemorative gatherings or ceremonies, you know, or breaking the habit that would result in alienation from the household of the Prophet?
Well, brothers and sisters, I just want to say that there is no doubt whatsoever that the obligatory prayers take precedence over the participation in the mourning ceremonies, mm-hmm. in the majalis and yes. the azadari, because we know for sure that the salat, the prayer, is the most important act of
worship. The pillar of the religion.
It's the pillar of religion. And it is something which serves as the basis, and every other thing is based on this pillar. And if this pillar breaks, mm-hmm. and if there is no such pillar, the whole construction, the whole building will collapse, and it will cease to exist. In fact, so therefore, we should not miss our prayers under any circumstance, no matter what the situation. As mentioned by His Eminence, the obligatory prayer, and also as is stated clearly in the riwayat, in the mm-hmm. traditions and the hadith, of course, the obligatory prayer takes precedence over any other act, and including the participation in the majalis, in the gatherings of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, and the gatherings which are meant to commemorate the event of Ashura and the martyrdom of the infallibles. So it is not permissible to overlook an obligatory act under the pretext of taking part in the majalis and gatherings as such as the morning ceremony held for Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam.
I see.
And that's very important. And mm-hmm. unfortunately, we see that some men and women, they take part in the events of Ashura and they remain awake until late at night, for example, 3 o'clock. And in the morning, it's absolutely difficult for yes. such people to wake up. And therefore, there should be an arrangement for offering the Fajr prayer.
Yes.
People, in order for them not to miss the prayer, they should use their mobile phone or an alarm clock to wake up for the prayer, because if you miss your prayer, you have lost a great, you have missed a great reward.
Exactly. And a very quick question here I may squeeze in at the end of this episode. Sheikh, during the month of the Muharram, as we all know, the commemorative processions and the sounds of drums and trumpets sometimes continue until after midnight. What is your view on such a practice?
Well, staging processions, taking to the streets and to commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam and his companions, and also taking part in these religious ceremonies is a good practice. It is a good act. It is a good work. It is commendable, and there's no objection in it. And of course, it is among the best deeds by which one can seek closeness to Allah. It is a means of proximity to God.
I see.
But one must be mindful not to embark on any action which might cause distress, which might cause, disturbance, mm-hmm. or which may cause a headache to other people. Otherwise, it's going to be haram.
Okay.
And one should not do a recommended act which leads to a haram act,
mm-hmm. I see. That's a very important
disturbing thing. Others and creating headache, and bothering others is not for. Is
Thank
not
you very much, Sheikh. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws. And until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave. Mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein plan to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new lands.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection
of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on iRib English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
چیزی میشنویم راجع به حضرت زهرا که میگن ام الائمه بود.
Usually we only understand the literal meaning of the term ام الائمه as referring to حضرت فاطمه الزهرا. Only the literal meaning of the attribute ام الائمه is known to us. Literally, ام الائمه means the mother of the imams. This is true. However, Om also means the root. This means that Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra was both the mother and the root of the Imams of the Shiites, both physically and spiritually. The light of the Imams is from the divine light of Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra, and her light is from the light of Allah. As we read in the Ziyarat text of Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra, Allah put His light in Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra, and from her the other Imams took their light within. This means that Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra is the bridge between Allah's light and A'imma. In other words, any blessing that reaches the Ahlul Bayt from Allah is through the lightening character of Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra. This is really difficult to understand, but it is true. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech on iRib English Radio, Call of Islam page, which was the English translation of a short Persian speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
How many wars is the United States fighting right now?
Well, the answer is zero, as under the Constitution, Congress must declare war, and the last countries that Congress declared war on were Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary in 1942. 8 decades and what seems to be zero wars. Any countries with such a record must be one of the most peaceful places on Earth. But as history has shown, this is not the case with the US, as it is fighting and has waged wars on many countries across the world. It just doesn't want to call them wars. Over the last 20 years, the US has dropped an average of 46 bombs and missiles on other countries each day. And now, a new study has revealed that more than a quarter of the 400 wars which the US has sugarcoated in terms such as a military-led operation, police actions, or humanitarian interventions have taken place in West Asia and Africa. So it seems that as Americans struggle to address urgent needs at home, their governments have committed them to endless wars in an attempt to support what seems to be one of the key pillars of the US, the military-industrial complex. The
US has tried to be on the first hand, with an image of also being seen as a global policeman, which came and, of course, as some have argued, it's done more harm than good. When you look into the global dominance and production of all these weapons and also use of it in terms of interventions, you see a situation whereby US wants to be the first, to be seen the most powerful nation in the world, to be seen as the one that can intervene and maybe make a difference, whichever difference whose interest it serves. Of course, they will have to define that. It's a bit a gray area. You cannot define it very clearly.
The world seems to have entered a new era after the Second World War, one where relations between countries has been at a much more stable and peaceful state. But while the decline of war and the relative harmony among great powers is cause for celebration, the US seems to believe otherwise in light of its grand strategy and political powers that seem to be running its system, namely the military-industrial complex. The US has constantly, since the Cold War, intervened in foreign affairs and engulfed itself in wars far from its borders, wars which in most cases seemed endless and even pointless at times. But while the US military is swamped in conflicts in other countries, it's hard to see any end in sight, especially an end where it is the victor. A month into his presidency, Donald Trump said that the US no longer wins wars as it once did. And the reason behind this might be the fact that the US isn't necessarily in wars. It is in fact in foreign interventions where its presence has more often than not worsened the situation, further aggravating an already chaotic crisis. And all this may only be to support the thriving war business in the US. Big war CEOs say the chaos in the world has led to excellent prospects for them, while arms contractors say recent violence and tensions in the Ukraine conflict works in their shareholders' favor. And this leads to the questions that do war manufacturers and US foreign policy go hand in hand in promoting wars?
When you think about the terrorism happening within the Sahel region, and of course, US is an interventioning power also. They have to do what they have to do, use of drones and all these things. So they are giving us another reason as well. But elsewhere, whether it's in East Africa, Somali intervention, this is also given a different reason, campaign, war against terror. So there's always a reason being given. So therefore, war never looks like it's been manufactured or it's been planned, deliberately planned or calculated to maybe maximize sales of weapons. But truth be told, that whenever there's a conflict, weapons will always be used.
The U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents have found 11 sets of classified documents, with some marked as top secret, in Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida while executing a search warrant this week. The warrant was publicly released following a federal judge's order. It states investigators had probable cause to believe Trump violated three federal crimes, including violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of the government records. Media reports say the FBI search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was for possible classified materials related to U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejected that. He called it a hoax and claimed he had no stored classified information. The unprecedented raid on the residence of the former U.S. president provoked a backlash from leading Republicans who described the move as politically motivated. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, said the search of Trump's property was another escalation in the weaponization of federal agencies against the regime's political opponents. Also, Florida Senator Marco Rubio stated that Biden is using his power to persecute Trump. But the White House has denied the allegations, saying it was unaware of the search before it happened. Moreover, there have been growing threats in recent days against FBI agents and offices across the country. On Thursday, a man who tried to breach the FBI's Cincinnati office was shot and killed by police after he fled the scene. Law enforcement officials say the man may have been present at the January 6th riot. Right after news of the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago broke, there was a big spike in tweets referencing civil war. Analysts and reporters say this is alarmingly similar to the activities in the lead-up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Well, I think it's true that there are people in the permanent national security wing of the U.S. government who don't want Trump to return to office. And whether or not those people are currently raiding Trump in Mar-a-Lago in order to try to get proof of crimes they could use to charge him and put him in a position where he legally can't run for office.
Shockwaves spread across America in response to the news that the FBI had searched a private Florida residence of Donald Trump. It prompted threats of retaliation from the former U.S. president and his allies. The surge in violent rhetoric drew concerns that it could lead to civil unrest and a social crisis. Department of Homeland Security officials have been warning for months that this type of warlike rhetoric, which came to fruition on January 6th and which continues to be fueled by reactions to ongoing investigations of Trump, is increasing the risk of more widespread political violence ahead of the midterm elections in November. This comes as recent polls have shown a rising acceptance of political violence among Americans. About 1 in 3 Americans say they believe violence against the government can at times be justified. According to another study by researchers at the University of California Davis Violence Prevention Research Program and the California Violence Research Center released last month, more than half of Americans expect that a civil war will erupt in the U.S. sometime in the next few years.
I think it is a sign that the U.S. Polarization has gotten way out of hand and could be leading to a constitutional crisis and possible civil war or social breakdown kind of situation. We have seen this polarization growing for many years.
Meanwhile, as much as 40% of election and poll workers in the largest jurisdictions in the U.S. have so far said they won't be returning to their jobs out of their own fears. Other states are seeing drop-offs too. Nearly 1 in 3 local election workers said they felt unsafe because of their jobs. The alarming partisan divide within the U.S. political system ahead of the vital midterm elections in November had raised concerns over the possibility of internal conflict.
Tensions are still high between China and Taiwan. The flare-up comes days after the provocative visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. Officials in Chinese Taipei have rejected the one-country, two-systems plan proposed by China for the self-ruled island. Taipei says that only the Taiwanese can decide the island's future. The reaction came after China published a white paper on Taiwan, which Beijing says shows the resolute determination of Beijing to peacefully resolve the unification issue. The paper lays out China's position on the self-ruled island. It says Beijing would never allow any attempt to separate Taiwan, but also would make every effort to achieve unification through peaceful means. Taiwan has accused Beijing of using House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit as, quote, an excuse to destroy the status quo. Pelosi visited the island on August 2nd, despite vehement protests from China.
What they want to do with Taiwan is fight, U.S. wants to fight China to the last Taiwanese. If not to the last Japanese, if not enough, then to the last Korean. Ultimately, the U.S. will not fight the wars. It will finance them. It will give weapons. It will antagonize us. It will antagonize both sides. And that's what they want to do. And it's actually a replica to the World War II.
Beijing reacted with an unprecedented burst of military around the island. The drills lasted for several days. Taiwan has also launched live fire drills in the wake of China's largest ever military exercises. The white paper issued by China this week was the third document of its kind over Taiwan. The previous editions were the Taiwan Question and Reunification of China, which was published in 1993, and the One China Principle and the Taiwan Question, which came out in 2000. China insists differences in the social systems in mainland and Taiwan are, quote, neither an obstacle to reunification nor a justification for secessionism. But Beijing says it will not rule out the military option to achieve such reunification.
What China wants to do with this white paper is just to find a way with Taiwan to get it back to its sense, because reunification will happen. The problem is that if it doesn't happen peacefully, it will happen by force. China doesn't want to do it by force, but it's being pushed on the corner by the U.S. because the U.S. is actually slowly declaring Taiwan independent.
Speaker Pelosi's controversial visit has undermined the One China policy, which is recognized by nearly all countries of the international community, including the United States. Under the policy, the international community recognizes Taiwan as part of China, and the U.S. is committed to recognizing and having formal ties with China rather than the island of Taiwan. But Washington, contrary to its stated policy, continues to undermine China's sovereignty and courts the secessionist government in Taipei.
So what is the one country, two system? It was applied actually the first time is in Hong Kong. And so since the handover in 1997, they applied the one country, two system. The way it was done in Hong Kong was that Hong Kong could keep its a very high degree of autonomy. And actually they did it for Hong Kong. And it was a way, a showcase that they could show to Taiwan to say, well, in case you were to reunify with the mainland, this would be the system.
China has proposed the one country, two systems model to win Taiwan back. The policy allowed the Chinese government to successfully solve the question of Hong Kong through diplomatic negotiations with the British government. Hong Kong was under colonial British rule since the 19th century. China resumed to exercise its sovereignty over the island on July 1, 1997.
But what happened in Hong Kong was that you had the external forces. You had a massive amount of money being poured by NED, National Endowment for Democracy, and you had the usual suspect, the whole team of regime change working for the US, the MI6, and they did everything to destroy the one country two system in Hong Kong, and that ended up with the riots. And then in 2020, you had the national security law.
Under the model, offshore regions like Hong Kong remain under China's sovereignty but can retain their own economic and administrative systems. Now China insists the same model could be applied to Taiwan.
Iran is making giant leaps in its peaceful space program. Iran has just launched its Khayyam satellite into orbit. The satellite was sent into space from the Moscow-operated Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. Khayyam satellite was sent into orbit on Tuesday by Soyuz 2.1B rocket. Iran says it will also use imagery from Khayyam to monitor Iran's borders and improve the country's capabilities in management and planning in the fields of agriculture, natural resources, environment, mining, and natural disasters. After all, Iran is surrounded by US bases, and terrorists have preyed on Iran to enter its soil to conduct terrorist operations. Contrary to claims made by Western media outlets, Tehran insists the Khayyam satellite is fully controlled by Iranian experts and technicians based inside Iran from the very beginning of its launch.